listening to WGDR. Plainfield, Goddard College's community radio station. We now begin our broadcast day. We operate at 91.1 FM with a power output of 920 watt, and our licensee is the Board of Trustees of Goddard College. Our studios and transmitter are located in the Elliott Pratt Center at Goddard College, and our mailing address is P.O. Box 336 in Plainfield, Vermont 05667. WGDR is made possible by the financial support of Goddard College and complimentary contributions from listeners, foundations, and underwriters. And while on the official business, the following program presents the opinions of its participants and producer, and do not reflect an opinion, an official opinion, of WGDR or its licensee, Goddard College. The show, spanning the chasm, bridging the schism, with a healthy spasm of skepticism, or perhaps even indecision. This is Peter. I call myself a poet. Behind me are didgeridoos. This didgeridoo is in D. And that's a Glockenspiel providing the bells. Mostly in D. This is D. And the other didgeridoo is B flat. B flat. I love this one. This is my favorite didgeridoo. It's a simple didgeridoo. A simple stick. Termite hollowed stick. A beautiful piece. And this is the B. The D is also a beautiful instrument. It's like a concert-grade didgeridoo, but has a complex, rich sound. But I love the B-flat as well. There's the B-flat. Now they're both together here. So we proceed with the day with a contribution from the resonance of hollow sticks provided by termites from stringy bark. Eucalyptus grown in the northern territories of Australia. But we span the chasm here. We cross the globe. And so with a didgeridoo background and a distinct predilection for Pope, the poet, who, I don't know, if you are a regular listener, of course, you will be aware that I have recently run into Pope and find him wonderfully appropriate, and have been reading him in these early morning hours, and will continue to do so today. Here is a short piece from an essay on criticism. This is a lovely piece. It's short and it talks about the process of poetry. True ease comes. Oh dear, I started with an error. Let me try this again. True ease in writing comes from art, not chance. As those move easiest who have learned to dance. 'Tis not enough, no harshness gives offense. The sound must seem an echo to the sense. Soft is the strain when zephyr gently blows, and the smooth stream in smoother numbers flows. But when loud surges lash the sounding shore, the hoarse, rough verse should like the torrent roar. When Ajax strives some rock's vast weight to throw, the line too labors, and the words move slow. Not so when swift Camilla scours the plain, flies o'er the unbending corn, and skims along the main. Hear how Timotheus's varied lays surprise, and bid alternate passions fall and rise. While at each change, the son of Libyan Jove now burns with glory, and then melts with love. Now his fierce eyes with sparkling fury glow. Now sighs steal out, and tears begin to flow. Persian and Greek, like turns of nature found, and the world's victor stood subdued by sound. The power of music all our hearts allow, and what Timotheus was is Dryden now. Dryden or Mary or Peter or Padma, any one of those, and many more, could fit that last name. True ease in writing comes from art, not chance, as those move easiest who have learned to dance. 'Tis not enough, no harshness gives offense. The sound must seem an echo to the sense. Soft is the strain when zephyr gently blows, and the smooth stream in smoother numbers flows. But when loud surges lash the sounding shore, the hoarse, rough verse should like the torrent roar. When Ajax strives some rock's vast weight to throw, the line too labors, and the words move slow. Not so when swift Camilla scours the plain, flies o'er the unbending corn, and skims along the main. Hear how Timotheus's varied lays surprise, and bid alternate passions fall and rise. While at each change the son of Libyan Jove now burns with glory, and now melts with love. Now his fierce eyes with sparkling fury glow. Now sighs steal out, and tears begin to flow. Persians and Greeks, like turns of nature found, and the world's victor stood subdued by sound. The power of music all our hearts allow, and what Timotheus was is Dryden now. A piece from Alexander Pope. From On Criticism, which is an early work, but a beautiful lesson in writing poetry. This show, Spanning the Chasm, has been occurring on Wednesday morning from 6 to 8 usually, and I pick up times during the rest of the week every now and then, but we're going to expand now to the Saturday time slot from 10:30 to 12:30. And so, Spanning the Chasm, which is certainly devoted to freeform radio and spontaneous performance of poetry and readings with a musical background, and usually in B flat or D, we have an opportunity. Now, the show has evolved over about a year, and I suppose there are several, maybe three main parts. One, I tend to read long poems from people I consider great poets. Pardon my value judgment here, but people I consider great poets, and I will tend to read long poems that may never have been read on the radio before. In fact, I'm absolutely certain of that in many cases. And that's hard listening radio, I do believe, because it demands attention. And after all, who waking up at six really can afford to give full attention to the radio, really? We're performing our toilet, making our coffee, breakfast, preparing for the day. And out of that comes these dulcet radio tones, this voice, reading some really difficult material. Yes, Pope and Johnson. The prosody of these people is absolutely precise, and the language they use is filled with hidden caesuras, hidden pauses, which you have to deduce as you read. It's not that easy. It is difficult reading and demanding listening, and I know that's why I call this hard listening radio. I'm sorry, I do rather lay it out on you. And one of the reasons I do that, of course, is I'm educating myself. And I go away and I listen to those poems. And yes, it is hard listening radio, and sometimes I have to listen to a poem 5 or 6 times, and each time I unearth a deeper layer. And sometimes I actually never perceive what the essence of the poem is until it comes clear on the 6th or 7th reading, or listening. In my case, I rather listen than read. I don't consider myself a good reader, believe it or not. And I find it difficult to read, and reading demands total concentration. And so while I read, it's hard to listen. And I like to listen, frankly. Now, I realize this opportunity exists by which we can concentrate some of that more difficult radio listening. And let me just tell you what I hope to do on that score in the future. I hope to read. I hope to read Alexander Pope's The Dunciad. And after that, as if that wasn't enough, after that, I'm going to read the Iliad as translated in rhyming couplet, in heroic couplet by Alexander Pope. That is a long book. That is a book that will take me maybe as much as half a year to a year to finish. It consists of 24 books from the contention between Achilles and Agamemnon to the redemption of the body of Hector. And after that, once I find it, these are all second-hand books, once I find it, I will then read The Odyssey by Pope. And, well, this is hard listening radio, and I've got a lot of extremely wonderful poetry to read. But I don't want you to shoot your radio, okay? So you can't take it out on your radio. If it gets too much, you can always turn it off. I am doing this in a way to put Pope's work onto CD and onto the internet in an oral form. And it's a long-term project. And I'm very sorry, but I'm going to do it over the radio live, with the didgeridoo in the background. And that is one of these 3 legs of this. The other, of course, is I love to read science. The show is spanning the chasm, and I try to encompass that chasm, which, if you'll forgive me for saying so, I consider to be fictitious. So I'm spanning a fictitious chasm between the arts and the sciences. It's easy to span a fictitious chasm, and very impressive when everyone else is convinced of its existence. And so, I do like to read long articles directly from the scientific literature. Now, you know as well as I do that that is not the easiest language, although it is often the tersest, most elegant scientific communications that you can ever imagine, filled with beautiful, resonant, complicated, and polysyllabic words, which have all kinds of rhyming possibilities, filled with new language. And language, of course, you know how much I love language, especially the English language, but I love language. And science today is one of the major sources of new language and wonderful, high art concepts, high art in abstracts and things like that. So I like to read scientific material straight from the source and glory in the language of science, which again is hard listening radio. And at this point we have a choice of whether to concentrate science on Saturday mornings and maybe throw a cast, an environmental cast, onto the science and the program, to some extent to keep up the tradition of people who have occupied that spot before. You know who I'm speaking about. And in that tradition, this is, after all, sacred ground that holds the spirits of those who've come before. Yes, yeah, sometimes you have to laugh at yourself, and my didgeridoo provides that for me. Oh, yes. And then, of course, the third leg, is my own poetry, which I perhaps produce a good full 2 to 4 hours of spoken word per week. And I've started not reading it all because it's simply too much, but it's has a harsh political edge and a rude poetic voice sometimes in these highly political days of these highly political days. Some critical poetry, some scathing social satire is sometimes appropriate, and I have the option of confining that to the very earliest morning hours, starting at 6, and blasting away. or I could also keep that to Saturday. And at some point, I would like your feedback. I know, actually, I may have mentioned the number for this radio station, which is area code 802-454-7762. I actually have only ever said that in a rhyming verse before, and I have not actually invited too many comments, although a flow of comments has come in, spontaneous, I consider them, and welcome. But at some point, dear listener, you who've remained silent, I know you've remained silent, because I run into you on the street every now and then and you recognize me if I just say a phrase. And so, you who've remained silent, I'm going to give you an opportunity to criticize me and to rearrange the program, perhaps, with due consideration of communication and agreement. We can possibly open a discussion on the nature of the program and where to place what and in what order to proceed and whether to really open the phone lines with this brand new phone system, which I'm looking at over my shoulder. I'll just have to see if it works. I believe it does, but not under my hands, not yet. Anyway, we have the option. You know, tetrahedrons are four-sided, three-dimensional figures. They're one of the Platonic forms, tetrahedra. They're made of the isosceles triangle, the sided triangle, the 60-60-60 triangle, which is very definitely a sacred shape. The Star of David is composed of two of them, inverted one over the other. But the triangle shape is, you know, just after the circle in the importance of shapes and structures in the universe. And I'm talking about the structure of quartz. And a lot of the silicate crystals. Now, we live in a cosmos, and we like to think of it as a cosmos of the mind, the conception and the perception. But the truth is, we live in a gassy, dusty cosmos. Gas and dust. A few stars sprinkled here and there. And a lot of emptiness, a lot of nothing but gas and dust. And that is what we are made of after all. And that is what stars are made of. And in that dust, in its cold form, is primarily ices of gases and volatiles, but also these oxides and silicates. Now, silicate is an oxide. Oxygen is one of the byproducts of stars from those gases. But when silicon and oxygen get together, or aluminum and oxygen, or titanium and oxygen, or iron and oxygen, or any one of those with any one of the metals with an affinity for oxygen get together, they form these wonderful crystals, of which you would be familiar, magnetite, iron oxide, hematite also, rutile, titanium oxide, what makes paper white, what makes toothpaste white, calcium carbonate, CaCO3, all those oxygens stuck onto carbons and metals. Well, of all those particulate creatures, primarily crystalline, but not all, that float in this cosmos, the silicates are very important, and the silicates are tetrahedral structures, and tetrahedral structure dominates the dusty world of the cosmos in the solid fraction. Of course, there are many other things, like garnets and dodecahedron and icosahedron and other wonderful forms to the crystals. But the tetrahedron is one of the basic shapes that resists distortion because of its triangular structure. And we see tetrahedral structures in diatoms, for example, and in the water molecule, tetrahedrons. And this show has a tetrahedral quality to it, in that I deal with science and poetry, other people's poetry and my own poetry, science and arts. Let's call it the four sides. It may be a distorted tetrahedron. You know, everything on the planet is distorted. Everything in the cosmos is slightly distorted. And everything has defects. And certainly this program has its share of them. But we're looking at the future and talking about change. I could stop completely, which I could do right after the election, because that, after all, is the most important global political event in the next little while. And I could stop right after that and stop this hard listening radio, because I know, dear friends, it is not easy to listen to Alexander Pope for 2 hours. However, or maybe 1 hour. However, on Saturday, maybe we can open the board for a discussion with you, dear listeners. If you could perhaps consider how you would like this show to progress, whether you want it to continue or not, how you want its format to be. I'm going to throw it open to the community on Saturday, and you can give your comment between poems and between readings. Okay, enough on that. This is WGDR, Plainfield, Vermont. I call myself Peter the Poet. This is Spanning the Chasm. Spanning the chasm, and speaking of structure and tetrahedrons and hexagons and cubes, let me just read this article before I get back to poetry. Forgive me for jumping around. This is an article from Science News for the 2nd of October, 2004, volume 166, and this is on page 219, and it shows what will be a very familiar sight to anyone who buys fruit at the co-op or a supermarket. Stacked fruit. And this is a very beautiful composition, including oranges, red apples, and green apples, and grapefruit. In 1998, mathematician Thomas Hales made headlines by settling a nearly 400-year-old question. What is the best space-saving way to stack oranges? Johannes Kepler, the natural philosopher who first realized that planets orbit the sun in ellipses, conjectured in 1611 that fruit sellers already had it right. The best packing is the familiar pyramidal arrangement seen in markets all over the world. This is an article called Oddballs, and it's by Erica Klarreich, or Klarreich, or Klarreich. 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 Yeah, it must be Klarreich. Anyway, it's K-L-A-R-R-E-I-C-H. Erica. So, Kepler conjectured in 1611 that fruit sellers already had it right, and that the best packing is the familiar pyramidal arrangement seen in markets all over the world. Despite the simplicity of this proposed solution, providing Kepler's conjecture, proving Kepler's conjecture, turned out to be elusive for centuries, and in the end required the assistance of a computer, Hale's 250-page paper is so complex that referees have spent 6 years poring over its details, and although they still haven't checked every one, they recently gave the paper the thumbs up to be published in digest form in the Annals of Mathematics. Now, you will remember that wonderful Pope two-liner. Let me see if I can recall it just off the blue. Of all there, mathematics alone was unconfined, too mad for material chains to bind. Isn't that appropriate? Still, I love mathematics. I love mathematics, but seriously, man. You got a 250-page paper, which other referees have spent 6 years poring over before approving it for publication in digest form in Annals of Mathematics. Hale's opus would seem to lay to rest the question of how to stack fruit. Yet, for mathematicians who are not constrained to the familiar world, Hale's work is just the beginning. Hale, who is now at the University of Pittsburgh, figured out how to stack three-dimensional oranges. But what is the best way to stack oranges in four dimensions, five dimensions, or n dimensions? It may be hard to visualize an n-dimensional orange. They taste good, though. It is easy to write an equation to define its shape, a sphere, in any dimension. A sphere is simply the set of all points at fixed distance away from a chosen center point. The question of how to densely pack spheres, or atoms, I might say, by the way, this is totally appropriate to the way crystals are formed. Matter itself is formed in a similar fashion. So when we talk about packing spheres, we're not just talking about fruit. We're talking about the substance of solid matter. The question of how to densely pack spheres in a dimension higher than three may seem fanciful and abstruse. Yes, sir. Sphere packings, however, are intimately connected to what are called error-correcting codes. These are central to a wide range of noisy data transmission applications such as sending messages from space probes to Earth. Using coding techniques, mathematicians have uncovered a surprise. Although the definitions of spheres in every dimension are analogous, the configurations of spheres that the various dimensions can contain are very different. Results from two research groups are providing new glimpses of the uniqueness of various dimensions. In recent work, Oleg Musin, an independent mathematician based in Los Angeles, an independent mathematician. That means he doesn't have a job. That means he's an out-of-work mathematician. Right. Like independent poets. Same thing. An independent mathematician based in Los Angeles has used coding ideas to tackle a problem closely related to sphere packing called the kissing problem. Oh, yes, I love this. Called the kissing problem. It asks, how many spheres can fit around or kiss a single central sphere? The sphere packing problem, by contrast, asks what arrangement of spheres can fit most densely into all of space. When it comes to three-dimensional oranges, the kissing number is 12. Ooh, I could kiss an orange right now. Mm. Musin has now proved that the kissing numbers in The kissing number in dimension 4 is 24. The 24 spheres that surround the central sphere trace a highly symmetric four-dimensional shape called the 24 cell, which has no analog in any other dimension. That's interesting. Meanwhile, a trio of mathematicians has come up with compelling numerical evidence, just shy of a proof, that the best sphere packings in dimensions 8 and 24 are particularly symmetrical arrangements known as the E8 lattice and the Leech lattice, respectively. In other dimensions, even the best packings known are less symmetrical. It seems mysterious, but there are these special dimensions out there, says Henry Cohn of Microsoft Research in Redmond, Washington, a member of the team that performed the second study. I don't know of any really good conceptual explanation of why dimensions 8 and 24 work out so nicely. That's octahedral and icosahedral. Error-proof packing. To see the connection between n-dimensional spheres packing, to see the connection between n-dimensional sphere packing and error-correcting codes, imagine that Alice wants to transmit a message to Bob via radio signals. Before the message is sent, Alice and Bob must agree to code to a code that translates each word in their vocabulary into a unique signal. If Alice and Bob can measure the strength of, say, 24 different frequencies of each radio signal, then each word corresponds to 24 coordinates, the strength of the signal's corresponding frequencies. In other words, the code translates each word into a point in 24-dimensional space. In an ideal world, Alice would send a radio signal for each word in her message, and Bob would simply measure the 24 coordinate of each signal and look up the corresponding word. But in the real world, information channels are noisy and errors inevitably creep in. Thus, the point in 24-dimensional space that Bob receives will probably be slightly different from the one Alice sent. If the receiving point is close to only one of the points in Bob's codebook, it will be easy for Bob to guess which word Alice meant. But if the point is close to two different points in his codebook, the message will be ambiguous. And I'm going to pull away for a minute because I see the phone system is lighting up, and I will continue later. Dear friends, hang on. I'll be back.
Anil Kumble has taken his off.
Are you there, Bob? Are you there, Bob?
I am.
Oh, excellent. I'm not quite sure how I did that. Now, let me just pull this music down. All right. You're there.
I am still here.
Okay, well.
See? All right.
Yeah, and all you have to do is figure out what you did, right?
Yes, I'm not quite sure. I did several things, some of which didn't work, and then all of a sudden there you were.
Yeah, keep pushing buttons.
Okay, that's what I did.
So, hey,
how are you?
I'm fine.
All right, what do you have for us today, dear friend?
Well, I have some beautiful weather, lots of sunshine, warmer temperatures than yesterday for daytime, but we should address the situation outside right now, which certainly has gone in many locations in north central Vermont, past scattered light frost to hard freeze. Certainly that's the case right up here on the hill. Now that the skies are lightening and I can look out, I see frost well up into the saplings, you know, 20, 30 feet off the ground. Everything below that is looking quite stiff and frozen. Temperature here right now, 26.8 degrees. And there are a lot of mid-upper 20s out there, and it's been below freezing for a while, so as the sun gets to work today, we're going to see a transformed landscape in north central Vermont as a lot of leaves will drop off trees. A lot of stuff is certainly going to look different than it did yesterday. The first widespread hard freeze happening this morning. But if you had your garden covered up or did whatever you needed to do to prolong your growing season, it's going to work out pretty well because this is going to be the last time we see this kind of cold for at least a week anyway. So that's the plus side, one of the plus sides. The other plus side is when you get this kind of cold temperatures, it does mean clear skies, and that means daytime sunshine. That's what we're looking at today. Partially sunny skies. As I say, warmer than yesterday, highs today should be getting up mid, maybe some upper 50s. Winds expected to be light. Partially cloudy tonight and not nearly as cold, upper 30s to around 40 for most of us. And then tomorrow, Thursday, another beautiful day with plenty of sunshine, warmer still, significantly warmer actually. Tomorrow's highs probably getting up into the mid-60s. And then for Friday, more sunshine, upper 60s to around 70. Friday night, partially cloudy, a few light passing rain showers, lows in the mid-40s, a few rain showers on Saturday, and just a few. Earlier in the week, it looked like Saturday might be a wet day, really wet day. At this point, it just looks like a few scattered showers, so that's good news if you have outdoor plans for Saturday. And Sunday, nice, sunny, dry day, but with cooler temperatures as the cold front is going to be bringing those showers on Saturday, look for Sunday's highs only in the low to mid-50s as opposed to getting up around 60 on Saturday. And Friday, as I said, really looking good. We could be getting back up around 70 degrees. And one of the things, besides killing off a lot of the foliage outside the cold weather this morning, does is it sets us up for the next stretch of nice weather, and you know, it might be tomorrow and Friday, well, that's just a couple of day stretch, Indian summer. Because one of the definitions, or the big definition of Indian summer, is it's nice warm weather, an extended period of nice warm weather, following the first really cold weather of the season. So we've got that first really cold weather of the season recorded. That's today, and after that, if we get a several-day stretch of really nice warm weather, we can call it Indian summer. And some of us may be feeling like that by the time we get to Friday because things are really going to improve.
Great.
So no matter what you call it, whether you call it Indian summer or not, it looks good. As I say, for gardeners, this is going to do it for this kind of cold. But, boy, it is certainly cold out there this morning. It really is a sobering thing to look out and see frost in the trees.
Yes, there was a good thick layer down this morning.
Yeah.
I've lost all my tender stuff, but now the collard greens and the crucifers are coming into their own.
Oh, yeah, which is one of the things that I always liked or disliked when people say this kind of weather brings the end of the growing season. It doesn't. It just brings a change.
A change.
In the growing season.
To the hardy ones.
Yeah, yeah. There's,
right.
There's stuff out there right now that doesn't mind this at all.
Not a problem.
Not a problem. But if you've got a commute, you're going to be doing probably a little windshield scraping this morning.
The beans are finished.
The beans are finished, right. And the tomatoes are probably also a thing of the past. But it's October. it comes at some point, and for many of us, that point this morning. But lots of sunshine today, a beautiful day tomorrow and Friday. All in all, things are looking pretty good. And the Red Sox won.
Who? Oh, that's that football team, right?
No, that's that baseball team. But we'll talk more about that.
You could teach us. That was you on that program, wasn't it?
That was.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, that was Phillip's idea, and I think it was a great idea. He asked me if I'd like to join him, and I said,
so.
Sure.
Diversity.
Yeah.
Yeah, all those football fans?
And I miss, I used to love it when Miss Kitty and Stu Bouts were talking sports.
No, I never
ago,
heard that.
Monday morning, so it's fun to bring a little sports.
Yes, I think it's totally appropriate.
Yeah, and boy, do we have something interesting coming up on Friday. So, folks, tune in and see what Phillip's got for you this Friday morning.
What time is that?
We're on at 7:30.
7:30 to 8.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one. Enjoy the sunshine.
You too.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye. News. This is WGDR, Plainfield, Vermont. This is Peter, the show Spanning the Chasm. And I'm reading about oddballs. It's easier to pack spheres in some dimensions than others. And I was reading about how packing of spheres and error coding is related. I'm not quite sure I actually grasped that, but I will continue reading. To avoid that problem, Alice and Bob should choose their coding so that the points that correspond to words far apart, so that the points that correspond to words are far apart. If, for example, the transmission error tends to move a point by at most one unit of distance, then Alice and Bob could choose their code points so that they are at least 2 units apart. In other words, the points would be at the centers of non-overlapping 24-dimensional spheres of radius 1. I'm not sure this is an appropriate analogy, but anyway. That way, whenever Alice sends Bob a word, even if some error creeps in, Bob can still recover the original message. This error-proofing protocol amounts to a sphere-packing configuration. The more tightly packed the spheres, the more words Alice and Bob can encode in a given region of space. So, the most efficient codes correspond to the densest sphere packings. When the late Claude Shannon launched the theory of error-correcting codes in the 1940s, high-dimensional sphere packing instantly became a hot topic. Cohn says, before that, if you told someone you were interested in 24-dimensional sphere packing, unless they were a pure mathematician, they would look at you as if you were crazy. Too mad for material chains to bind, said Pope. In 1973, Philippe Delsart of the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium developed a method for relating the size of the errors that a code can correct to the efficiency of the code, that is, the number of code words it can fit into a given space. Since the largest error a code can correct corresponds to the radius of the spheres, and the efficiency of a code is closely related to the density of sphere packing, Delsarte's method immediately became a powerful tool for studying sphere packings. In the late 1970s, mathematicians used Delsarte's methods to figure out the kissing numbers in dimensions 8 and 24. In dimension 8, they found it's possible to fit 240 spheres around a single central sphere. In dimension 24, the mind-boggling 196,560 spheres can crowd around one sphere. These results were obtained by Andrew Aldzyko of the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis and Sloan at AT&T Shannon Laboratory in New Jersey, and independently by Vladimir Levenstein of the Keldysh Institute of Applied Mathematics in Moscow. After this burst of progress, the study of higher dimensional kissing numbers and sphere packings plunged into a dry spell for more than two decades, says Gunter Ziegler, a mathematician from the Technical University in Berlin. What's exciting to me is that now new things are happening, Ziegler says. Suddenly, from different corners of the field, there are new insights into how to get results. In dimension 2, the solution to the kissing number and sphere packing problems are easy to spot. Slide some pennies around a table, and it quickly becomes clear that exactly 6 pennies can kiss a central penny, forming a hexagonal arrangement. The hexagonal pattern can be extended to the entire tabletop. Since antiquity, mathematicians have considered this arrangement to be the densest possible two-dimensional sphere packing, but their intuition was mathematically proved only in the early 20th century. In dimension 3, 12 billiard balls can fit around a central one. Just as the 6 pennies in dimension 2 sit at the corners of a regular hexagon, the 12 balls in dimension 3 also sit at the corner of a regular shape, an icosahedron that has 20 triangular sides. The icosahedron with 20 triangular sides. And those are the triangles I was talking about when I was talking about the tetrahedron. In the two-dimensional case, the 6 pennies lock tightly into place around the central penny. But in dimension 3, gaps exist between the 12 balls. Legend has it that this wiggle room gave rise to the famous controversy between Isaac Newton in 1694, between Isaac Newton and mathematician David Gregory. According to this story, Newton maintained that only 12 spheres can fit around a central sphere, while Gregory believed it should be possible to squeeze in a 13th sphere. It was not until 1953 that mathematicians finally proved Newton correct. That's interesting. I mean, all they had to do was take 12 billiard balls and try to fit a third one around it and see another one around it and see if they could. In dimension 4, I guess that's not a mathematical proof. In dimension 4, mathematicians have long had a prime candidate for the best kissing arrangement, the 24 cell, a perfectly symmetric shape with 24 corners and 24 three-dimensional sides that are all regular octahedra. Okay. The 24 cell, a perfectly symmetric shape with 24 corners and 24 three-dimensional sides that are all regular octahedra. If one four-dimensional sphere is placed at each corner, these 24 spheres all kiss the central sphere. That means the kissing number in dimension 4 is at least 24. However, it might be possible to fit more than 24 spheres around a central one. In 1979, Altzeichel and Sloan tried to use Delsarte's methods for error-correcting codes to prove that the kissing number is 24. Frustratingly, all the method could tell them was that the kissing number was at most 25, tantalizingly close to a kissing number, to the kissing number 24, but not close enough. In 2001, the problem caught the attention of Musin, a former mathematics professor at Moscow State University in Russia, who recently moved to the United States. Musin had learned about the kissing number problem as a high school student. However, he had heard nothing about the development in the 1970s using coding theory. Then 3 years ago, while working on a software development project for Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, he came upon a book about sphere packings. I spent maybe an hour reading the book and was so excited. Here's that mathematician then, you know. These are the chains that bind the mathematician. Intellectual stimulation. Then, 3 years... Musin resolved to solve the kissing number problem in dimension 4. I thought maybe I'd spend a week or so. Then I spent the week, and another, and finally I quit all my projects, all my work, and I became completely crazy about this problem. There's the madness. He's bound by the problem. Fortunately, Musin's wife, who was supporting the pair financially, was understanding. She asked me only one question. How long will it take you to solve this problem? Musin recalls, I said, 1.5 years, maybe 2 years. And she said that was okay. You know, here we have Musin's wife in the role of the supporter of science and mathematics. And, you know, there are many of us artists who have spouses that support our art. You know, the benefactor is often a single person and not a huge institution, a foundation, or a government. And it's true in art, where our spouses may support the endeavors of the artist. And here it's the same in mathematics, where his wife is supporting him. It's an amazingly generous instinct. Musin's estimate was right on target. After 18 months of non-stop work, he found a clever way. He found a clever way to modify an inequality arising from Delsarte's method to prove that the kissing number indeed is 24. I spent 16 hours a day without weekends to try to solve this problem, Musin says. When I got a solution, I was in shock. Mathematicians have yet to check out all the details of Musin's work, but his method seems entirely solid. It's very good research. Musin says he will spend another year trying to figure out whether his method can be extended to higher dimensions. That extrapolation may prove tricky because the 24 cell is unique in the pantheon of shape. In dimension 3, there are 5 perfectly regular or platonic solids. I mentioned that earlier. The cube, the tetrahedron, the octahedron, the dodecahedron, and the icosahedron. Dimensions 5 and higher contain just 3 platonic solids, analogs of the cube, tetrahedron, and octahedron. However, dimension 4 contains analogs of all 5 of the three-dimensional platonic solids, plus a sixth platonic solid, the 24 cell. Just why dimension 4 has an extra platonic solid is a puzzle to mathematicians. The 24 cell is this incredibly beautiful configuration that happens to fit perfectly in four dimensions for reasons that are mysterious. Oh, I love that. Listen, let me just repeat that last paragraph. Just why dimension 4, which is the dimensions we happen to live in, dear folk, just why dimension, when you include time, just why dimension 4 has an extra platonic solid is a puzzle to mathematicians. The 24 cell is this incredibly beautiful configuration that happens to fit perfectly in four dimensions for reasons that are mysterious. Oh, I love that. Beauty is mysterious, but it is highly symmetric. Dimensions of elegance. Dimension 4 is not the only standout when it comes to sphere packings. Mathematicians have long known that dimensions 8 and 24 contain exceptionally nice symmetric arrangements of spheres. The E8 lattice and the Leech lattice. Folks, I'm talking about beauty in mathematics here. Real beauty, as beautiful as anything you have ever seen, and perhaps more beautiful. Although mathematicians have not proved that these are the densest possible arrangements of spheres, no one has found a denser arrangement. In 2003, Cohn and Noam Elkies of Harvard University published a way to modify Delsarte's methods to produce upper limits for the densities of any sphere packing in dimensions 8 and 24. Now, Cohn and Abhinav Kumar, a graduate student at Harvard, have used computer analysis to calculate these upper limits to the 27th decimal place, and the numbers they have calculated agree perfectly with the densities of the E8 lattice and the Leech lattice. In other words, if there is a denser packing than the E8 lattice or the Leech lattice, it is denser by less than 1 part in 10 raised to the power 27th. That's a huge number. An almost unfathomably small amount. My feeling, and everyone else's, is that the odds are zero that another sphere packing beats the Leech lattice or the E8 lattice, Ziegler says. But in math, as long as it's not proved, there could be some miracle happening. In addition to being the leading candidate for the best sphere packing in dimensions 8 and 24, the E8 lattice and the Leech lattice also give the best kissing arrangements in those dimensions. What's more, the kissing spheres lock tightly into place. That means the dimensions 8 and 24 appear to share the simplicity and elegance of dimension 2, which we all understand, in which a single, highly symmetric, tightly locked configuration, the hexagonal packing, is both the best kissing arrangement and the best sphere packing arrangement. By contrast, in dimension 3, the most symmetrical kissing arrangement, the icosahedron, 20 sides, leaves wiggle room between the spheres, and it can't be extended to all of space, since icosahedra can't fill space without overlapping. It seems that dimensions 8 and 24 are very much better behaved than Dimension 3, Cohen says. The various dimensions are so individual. Listen to this. The various dimensions are so individual, he notes, that the only way to tackle the sphere problem is to get to know each particular dimension's quirks. Okay, dear friends. That's the end of that article. And I noticed somebody had tried to be phoning, and I'm so sorry for ignoring you. You're welcome to phone back right now.